The parsha this week is Toldos. That's the name of the portion. When you look at the psukim, the verses, without any Torah Shebal Peh, without any oral tradition, without any midrash, without any gemaras, with any other information, the verses by themselves don't seem to point to any sin on the part of Esav. That's how it reads on the surface. Because exactly, let's review the story again. So Rivka is barren for 10 years. She doesn't have any children. Then she has a very difficult pregnancy. She has a difficult pregnancy, and then she's really, like, really beside herself in a lot of pain. So she goes to the prophet of the day, Shame, goes to that the yeshiva Shame and Ava. It's a different discussion, but she goes there. She speaks to the prophet of the day, and he tells her that you have twins in your belly. You have twins in your womb, and one is going to be, one's going to eventually serve the other. Now, there's nothing negative. There's nothing. He doesn't reveal anything negative, good or evil, about the two twins inside of her. You have twins, and this, you know, you have struggling twins. They are, you know, they're just struggling. They're moving around very violently inside your womb. And then, you know, after they're born, right? They're born. So then, just says they, as they're growing up, you know, Esav is a hunter. And Yaakov is he dwells in tents. There's nothing bad about that. Nothing bad about being a hunter. You have to have hunters as well. So there's nothing, you know, negative about Esav revealed on the surface. And then he sells the birthright. Now, that maybe is a clue to what's going on. But then he sells the birthright. And then Yaakov has the right to the birthright. But there's nothing really overt about negative behavior on the part of Esav. But the overt negative behavior, so to speak, is the deceit of Yaakov and Rivka. So it's a very puzzling thing that on the surface of it. Now, history tells us what happened with the descendants of Esav, because the descendants of Esav become, throughout history, the persecutors and the anti-Semites against the Jewish people. So history proves that Esav is a Rasha. So when you hear the idea that Esav is a Rasha, Esav was a wicked one, there's no question historically he is the ancestor of peoples and nations who are persecuting the anti-Semites, the Nazis, Amalek, all of these people, the arch enemies of the Jewish people throughout history, all come from Esav, and Yaakov is the Jewish people. So history definitely proves the fact that Esav was the Rasha and Yaakov was the Tzaddik. But again, on the surface of the verses, there's nothing which really points more towards the righteousness, or not the deceit of Yaakov, more than the wickedness of Esav. Now Chazal reveal much more. Chazal is the Medrash, is the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral tradition. You can't rely upon, how many times do we say this? We can't rely upon the plain reading of the verses. What I've said so far is only the plain reading, just the superficial appearance of the verses. Right, but if you put into it and you add into it what Chazal say, what the rabbis say, as part of the oral tradition emanating from Sinai as well, so there's countless examples in the parasha itself of the indications of the wickedness of Esau. So just to name a few of them, for example, is that when he was tired, he came in, the pasuk says that he was tired, he was hunting, it says he was hunting, tired, and that's when he sold the lentils. Right, he sold his lentils to buy. So he bought the lentils from Yaakov to sell and sold the birthright. What was he tired from? The verse highlights the fact that he came in from the field. He was very, very tired. So Rashi brings the Medrash. He was tired because he had murdered that day. He was a murderer. That's one. Right. Another example, when it says he was a tzayed bepiv, when it says that he was a hunter. Right, again, superficially a hunter, but Chazal say he trapped his father. He used his skill of trapping. He trapped his father by deceiving. It's interesting. The first example of deceit in the parasha is not with Yaakov. This is the first example. What Chazal say that his deception was that he deceived him with his mouth by asking him very religious questions and very pious sounding questions. What the questions he asked him, the Medrash says, he asked him, you know, the law of tithing, taking a tithe off your produce. We all know you have to take a tithe off your produce. So he said, well, how do you take tithes off of straw? How do you take tithes off of salt? The truth is, there's no such thing as taking tithes off straw and salt, because straw and salt are only periphery types of items in the food preparation. we're not going into it, but you know, there's no such law of taking tithes off salt and straw. But he wanted to show, this is how Chazal explained, he wanted to show his extra piousness. He wants to know, to ask his father, you know, is there a way to take tithes off the straw and salt? It was really, it was duplicitous. It was like a tricky, it was in order to show his righteousness. He was trying to be more righteous than thou by asking these questions, but he wasn't being honest. But the other example of this, again, more examples, but one another notable example, you know, the day that he sold the birthright, right? And he bought the lentils for the birthright from Yaakov. That day, it was the day that Avram Avinu had passed away, that his grandfather had died. Avram had died. So Chazal say that he died, that Avram Avinu died on the day that Esav went off the derech. Going off the derech means going off the path. Going off the path and going to the path of immorality and all sorts of unrighteous things, that was the day that Avram Avinu passed away. And Chazal say the reason is because Hashem did not want to have Avram see his grandson go off the path, right? So he passed away. He was apparently maybe died younger than he was supposed to. I don't know, but anyway, he passed away on the day before he should see his grandson going off the path and going down the tubes and going away from the path of righteousness. But these are a few examples of how we see that Esav is understood by different parts of the story of how he was seen to be an unrighteous individual, an unrighteous person, right? And but again, the verses don't reveal this, right? The verses, again, on the surface, the only sin in the parsha is that actually there is one example which is more overt, is when he married later on, he gets married, and it says that his parents were not happy with the marriage, and it caused a lot of bitterness to them. But it doesn't really, you know, again, you know, there are many people who get married, and you know, and the parents don't like the choice of spouse, so it doesn't mean to say you're a bad guy, right? But the only overt example of sin, not sin, but what seems to be sin and mistake and unethical behavior is the deception of Yaakov and Rivka. But with regard to Esav, it doesn't come out so clearly. So where is it? Like where is the clue? Where's the telltale sign of his descent, which is revealed, which is very, very clear in the verses. The one part which really reveals his nature is when he sold the birthright. The selling of the birthright. Now, buying and selling, is nothing bad about buying and selling. Selling things, I can sell whenever I want, nothing immoral. But when you sell something so special and so valuable for something so temporal, that's a very, very telltale sign and a red flag that there's something wrong with this individual. There's something severely wrong with this person. What is he selling? The birthright. Now, the birthright doesn't just simply mean lots of property and lots of possessions, which that's also part of it as well. But the primary nature of the birthright that is to be conferred upon the firstborn is to carry on the legacy of the avos, of the patriarchs, to carry on this mission of what it means to be a Jew, essentially. Right? When Hashem chose the avos, chose the patriarchs and the matriarchs, we discussed this on Wednesday night, he chose them, right? He chose them they chose Hashem, but this relationship was established to carry on a legacy of living a life of purpose, of living a life of eternity. You know, I'd said this on Wednesday that the difference between a tzaddik, between a righteous person and a chassid and a pious person, the difference is a tzaddik does the right thing, but a chassid goes above and beyond and stretches himself to go beyond just doing the right thing. And really, more accurately, a chassid is reaching higher, even higher, to a different dimension. A tzaddik is very righteous, is doing things exactly according to the book, observing everything properly and being a righteous, honest, ethical individual. A chassid is trying to break boundaries. And what's the ultimate boundary to break? The ultimate boundary to break is the boundaries of the physical world. The boundaries of the physical world is the ultimate boundary to break. To break that boundary, to stretch outwards and to reach into a different dimension, the world of ruchnius, the world of spirituality. Mm. That's what a true chassid is. right? A chassid is, we're trying to get out of the parameters and the limitless, limited nature of the physical temporal world to go into a spiritual dimension, to live a higher purposed existence. The next world, spirituality, ruchnius, connection to God. This is the office. This is the patriarchs. This is the major. This is the Jewish people. This is the Jewish people. The difference between the one who carries that on and the one who doesn't carry on is, do you want that spiritual mission? Do you not want that spiritual? So when Esav sells the birthright, he's selling that connection and that role as carrying on that spiritual mission for all of eternity, for all of his descendants, for all of eternity. And chooses what? Lentils, physical things, the temporal, this world. That's all I want. I want to live in this. I'm happy with this life. It's so common. I mean, it's so applicable to every generation. I'm happy with this life. I'm happy with my house. I'm happy with my vacation. I'm happy with my clothes. I'm happy with my job. I'm happy. It's good. I'm good. I'm a tzaddik. I'm being a good, ethical, moral individual. I'm happy with everything. Right? I'm happy. I don't need the spiritual world. I don't need the world of spirituality and the afterlife and this lofty, ethereal, and this other dimensional existence. I don't need it. I'm happy with this world. Right, the answer, that's how you feel right now, right? That's how we feel right now. It's only when we see that other world and we continue on into life beyond this physical world, and we see, I made a mistake. There is a bigger reality out there, right? But this is what Esav does. Esav chooses the here and now. The here and now. He wants the here and now, instant gratification experience of the here and now, and not the spiritual mission that he's invested with as part of the Jewish people, the future Jewish people. But this is the first clue. I saw an article over here. It was well written by Rabbi Jonathan Sachs of Blessed Memory. It's called Covenant in the Conversation, and he highlights this. The name of the article is called Thinking Fast and Slow. Thinking Fast and Slow is actually a name of a book written by a secular book by a person by the name of Daniel Kahneman. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow, but it's essentially a book. It's about the way we think and the way we make decisions. We have the impulsive brain and we have the slow, deliberate brain, right? We all have this. Sometimes we think impulsively. Sometimes we think very, very with a lot of deliberation and slowness. So to read a few parts of this, he says that we have, in fact, a dual system or twin track brain. This is what Daniel Kahneman is referring to in this title of his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. One track is rapid, instinctive, emotional, and subconscious. The other is slower, conscious, deliberative, and careful. The former allows us to act quickly to situations of immediate potential danger. It's the fight or flight brain. It's the part of us which reacts to the danger or the need which needs to be responded to in the moment right now. And it has value. So that impulsive brain, the impulsiveness has value, has a place. But on the other hand, if we use that impulsiveness, in an inappropriate way, in a way which is dangerous, we ruin ourselves. We ruin ourselves because now we're acting impulsively. We're choosing the temporal impulsively and not thinking about it and making a decision for something which makes more sense down the road. Not all instincts are benign. Anger, envy, jealousy, fear, hate, and the desire for revenge may have application and have function, but they are often deeply destructive in social situations. That is why the ability to think slow, to pause and reflect, matters so much. All animals have desires. Only human beings are capable of passing judgment on desires, of asking, should I not satisfy the desire? But he applies this to Yaakov and Esav. Mm. Yaakov and Esav are an example of these two ways of thinking, impulsive thinking versus deliberate thinking. And this is all, it's also borne out in their natures because, again, go to Yaakov. He's an Yoshev Oalim, a dweller of tents, a dweller of tents. You get the picture of someone who is sitting quietly, calmly, meditating, thinking, deliberating. That was his nature. That was his proclivity. Now, I want to say that I'll elaborate on this as well. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with impulsivity. It has its time and place. You know, but this was, but Esav had that proclivity. He had that predisposition of impulsiveness. He was a tzai. He was a hunter. So there's a superficial, plain understanding of that description that he was a hunter. A hunter is fast. You got to be fast on your feet to be a hunter. So he was a hunter. He was, you know, very fast on his feet. Went for the target. Hunted down the animal, etc. The word Esav itself, right, is from the word osui in Hebrew, which means self-made, made or made. So there's a certain picture in the character of Esav that he is self, not self-made like a self-made man, but rather like ready-made, mm-hmm. already done. Like there's a certain speed in the word Esav. Esav, he's osui, he's made already, he's done, he's finished, right? He's done. There's a speed in it, there's a quickness, there's an impulsivity. He was a hairy person at a very young age. Everything grew very fast with him. He was very hairy when he was born. But the fact is, Esav is the impulsive one, choosing right away temporal immediate gratification over the spiritual mission that is really potentially would have been potentially available for him. That's a different discussion. You know, why Yitzchak wanted to give the brachas to him, and what would have happened if he wouldn't have chosen to sell the birthright. So it goes in a different direction. But the point is to think about is this, a very important idea, is that when Yaakov and Esav, right, were already in the womb, there was already indication then that they were pulling in different directions. There's nothing intrinsically wrong. You see, people ask this question, you know, was Esav destined to become a Rasha? Was he destined to become wicked? Right? The answer is no, of course not, because no one is destined to be anything of righteous or wickedness. No one has that intrinsic destiny. It's the choices we make, right? The proclivities are there. Yes, he had the proclivity of an impulsivity, which has its proper application and its proper address if used properly, if used to hunt for things which are necessary right now. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with that spontaneity. You know, you could really say that, change the word impulsivity to spontaneity. Sometimes you have to be spontaneous. Sometimes you have to react quickly, right? There's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. It's how you use it. It has more of a danger to go in the wrong direction than deliberation, right? And generally speaking, is that the more deliberate the person is, the more chances they're going to make the right decisions. But the challenge with a deliberate person is they're too slow, and then they, you know, they end up losing the opportunity, right? Or things they get attacked too quickly. That has its dangers too. But generally speaking, if you have to make a choice between being deliberate and being impulsive, you'd rather be deliberate than impulsive. But there's nothing intrinsically wrong. But this is why when they were born, right? Why is Yaakov called Yaakov? He's called Yaakov because of the word Akev, which is heel, because he's holding on to the heel of Esav when he's born, alluding to the idea, rein in your impulsivity. He's holding on to the heel of Esav. It's not, you know, it's not Esav's heel. It's not Esav who's called heel. It's Esav's heel that now is named, that name is now given to Yaakov, because Yaakov is holding on to Esav's heel. So now Yaakov gets the name heel because he's holding on to his heel because he's containing him. He's controlling him. He's reining him in. Well, who's older though? Who's the older of the two? Obviously, Esav is older of the two. He was born first because that's why technically he has the birthright. So the older one, right, is the younger one is now controlling the older one. He's now reining in the older one. The trait and the proclivity of being deliberate and thinking and analyzing and contemplating is reining in the impulsive one, the Esav, right? So where does that trait of contemplation and deliberation come from? It's really an expression of the Yetzer Tov, of the good inclination. The Yetzer Hara, right? The Yetzer Hara is the source of all that impulsivity. Or really, maybe you'd say that impulsivity and the Yetzer Hara are really one and the same thing. Yetzer Hara means the evil inclination. See, the evil inclination, you know, this is an interesting idea. We say in the Shema, love Hashem with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your might. Right? Love Hashem with all of your heart. So Chazal say, with both of your hearts, the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, the good inclination and the bad inclination. you know, I've got to love Hashem with my bad inclination, then how that seems to be a contradiction. If I have a bad inclination, that's contradictory to loving a God. The answer is no. The bad inclination, the root part of you, which is drawn towards that impulsive, spontaneous, instant gratification energy, which intrinsically is not bad, it's just how it's used. Take the desires for the physical, take the desires for whatever immediate things you may need, take that desire, that's the Yetzer Hara, and now channel it towards the service of Hashem, channel it towards the right purpose. So the Yetzer Hara is not, the Yetzer Hara is a gift to help us to control ourselves. The Yetzer Hara is described as, like, for example, it says when you know, one of the verses in Genesis, it says that chatas rovates the pesach, I forget the exact wording, that sin crouches at your door. Sin crouches at your door. So one of Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch explains that it's crouching at your door, and then the verse continues, and its desire is that you should control it. The verse says, and its desire is that you should control it. The Yetzer Hara is that impulsive, you know, impulsive nature, impulsive drive inside of us, which can really take us astray and cause destruction on our lives. But if we rein it in, then it's all for the good. It can be very, very powerful. If we can rein it in, take those desires and channel them towards the service of God and love of Hashem, it can all be good. That's why Yaakov is holding on to Esav's heel. He's reining him in, but he's older and he's younger, right? Yetzer Tov, good inclination, which is where that deliberation comes from, and the Yetzer Hara, which is where the impulsivity comes from, is young, is older. So when does the Yetzer Tov come into a person? The Yetzer Hara of a person, that impulsivity, is there right away from birth. Because children are impulsive. Kids are impulsive. They're just responding, reacting. Again, reaction, quick reactions sometimes are necessary. But it's really the Yetzer Hara. It's got to be reined in. It's got to be controlled. When does the Yetzer Tov come into the person? Bar mitzvah. Only a bar mitzvah. And that's why it says, Yado, his hand was holding on to the heel. Yad is gematria of 14. Numerical value of 14, Yud is 10 and Dalet is 4, because that process of reining in the impulsivity begins in the 14th year of a person's life, when the Yetzer Tov is introduced into the psyche of the person. Mm. So when it says that he's holding on to the heel, that Yaakov's hand, Yad, is holding on to the Akev, the heel of Esav. So in the 14th year of a person's life, when the Yetzer Tov is finally there, that's when the work begins of now reining in the impulsivity of our personalities. It's very, very difficult. We can train children to be in control. We can train them. We have to do that as parents. We have to, you know, that's our job as parents. But the internal, you know, automatic and self-motivated drive to rein in impulsivity, to activate, to have our Yetzer Tov, our good inclination, rein in that impulsivity that really doesn't begin until after Bar Mitzvah, into the 14th year of a person's life. Mm. But that's our job, that's our mission, and that's our mandate. Right? From that point onwards, we have to constantly, every single day, we have this impulsive part of ourselves. We have this impulsivity. We have the Esav inside of us. But the mission of our lives is to control and to rein in the impulsivity of the Esav inside of us with the deliberation, the thoughtfulness, and the contemplation of the Yaakov inside of us. That's our mission, to slow down, to think, to engage in, essentially, mindfulness. It's mindfulness versus impulsivity, right? Impulsivity got Esav into the worst trouble, and also for us, because of that, we are the objects of his demise, of his descent. But the mindfulness of Yaakov is that's who we are. That's who the Jewish people are. The Jewish people, we have to carry on that legacy of being mindful, of thinking and contemplating, studying, being like Yaakov, Yoshev Bo'olim, dwelling in tents, thinking and contemplating what life is about and what our purpose is. And I thought to myself, I don't know if this is true, but I think it certainly has a logical connection. The very, very first topic of the parasha, the very, very first topic is, again, the difficult pregnancy, or no, the fact that she was barren, the Rivka was barren, right? She has no children. The theme of the very, very first few verses, the Porsche, is about tefillah, is about prayer. So actually, this is the beginning. If you know, I was debating what I should focus on, right? The beginning of the portion is a big lesson about prayer. In fact, actually, if you look at the beginning, it says when she was, it says that Yitzchak was 40 years old when he married Rivka, and they didn't have children, right? And they prayed, Yitzchak prayed facing Rivka, right? Because she was barren. So one of the commentators says, the Rabbeinu Bechaya says, why does it say it in that order, right? That he prayed because she was barren. Because she was barren, that's why he prayed, right? That we oftentimes think that the struggles we're in, or the things we're praying for, we're trying to pray to get rid of the struggles, to get rid of the hardship, to get rid of the things which are bothering us. There's a mistake in that. It's true, we are doing that. But the real understanding of hardships and challenges is they are created in order for us to pray. Hashem puts challenges into our lives in order for us to pray, in order for us to connect to Him. So therefore, the proper order, what's the cause and what's the effect? People think the cause is the suffering, and therefore the effect is the prayer. It's the opposite. The cause is the prayer, and the effect is the suffering. Because Hashem wants us to pray, to connect to Him, therefore He brings challenges to us in order to create a relationship. So there's a big lesson over here as well. Also, this comes on the heels of the last verse of the previous portion, where it says that that the descendants of Yishmael describes the location, the geographic location of the descendants of Yishmael, where they were. The very last phrase of the last portion is that literally, they translate this, is over all of his brothers he dwelt. That's what it says in the English. In the Hebrew, it says, over all of his brothers he fell. Which is an interesting word. He fell, nafal, he fell. It's so one of the commentaries says, because at the end of days, there will actually be a falling down of the descendants of Yishmael before the rising up of the descendants of Isaac, which is the Jewish people. In other words, eventually the time will come, Messiah will come, the Mashiach will come, and the whole world will recognize the oneness of Hashem, including the Arabs, including the Ishmaelites, including the Esav as well. But that's alluded to by that juxtaposition. Falling down, rising up. Falling down of Yishmael to the rising up of the Jewish people. But here's the interesting point, that the what was the key to the success of Yishmael? Like, what made him survive? Like, there was a point at which he was going to die. And it was because of prayer. Tefillah saved his life. Tefillah, prayer saved his life, and we see this who prays more than the Jews, right? Who prays more five times a day? They are known for their tefillah, prayer. So if we want to see the disappearance and the dissolving of all of these, you know, persecuting and torturous forces around us, we have to counter with the same degree of force. With our tefillah as well. And that's why tefillah is mentioned. That's why there's a highlight of tefillah, prayer, at the beginning of the portion. Mm-hmm. We need to take that weapon of prayer to fight the forces of evil who are using prayer. They did use prayer for their very existence, for their very survival. Mm-hmm. So we have to use prayer as well to fight that. But prayer is the beginning of the portion. So prayer is the message of the beginning of the portion. What is prayer? Prayer is meditation. Prayer is contemplation. We learned this also in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch this past week as well, that you can't go into prayer. You can't go into the main part of prayer is Ishmon Esrei, right? There's the silent of the Midah. You can't go into that without stopping, pausing. It says, before stepping into the Shmoneh, you've got to stop and pause, reflect, and extricate yourself from all of the physical desires around us. That's exactly what Yaakov is. He's the antithesis of the impulsive person who just jumps into things, jumping into davening, rushing the words, praying in a way which is not appropriate. So tefillah, prayer, requires a lot of slowness, a lot of slowing down, meditating, thinking, contemplating, reading the words. I mean, that's an essential thing, reading the words of the Siddur. And slowing and just meditate, using the mind. It's using the mind to make decisions and not using the heart to make decisions. Right now, to add one more interesting point to this, is that even in prayer, though, there's still a place for Esav. Where's the place for Esav in prayer? So if Esav, not Esav in the bad way, Esav is the impulsive nature. It's the impulsiveness, the impulsivity, or in other words, spontaneity. So in fact, actually, this commentaries talk about this. There are two types of prayer. There's spontaneous prayer, and then there's also deliberate prayer. Deliberate prayers from the Siddur, right? That's the deliberate, contemplative, thoughtful prayer of Yaakov. But the prayer which is spontaneous is you're walking down the street and you're in trouble, cry out to Hashem. That's called that's impulsive prayer. There's a place for it. There's a place for an Esav type of personality, impulsivity, spontaneity. Don't be like a stone. Don't be emotionless. Cry out to Hashem. You're driving somewhere. You're stuck in traffic and you're frustrated. Cry out to Hashem. Like, use that spontaneity, not as anger, but to cry out to Hashem, to talk to Hashem in a spontaneous way. But anytime you're doing anything, like to talk to Hashem, spontaneously talk to Hashem, that's also a type of prayer. This is a very, very valuable type of prayer. But this is the story. This is the story of Yaakov and Esav, right? Mm-hmm. This is the story. You know, they're not intrinsically bad, but they have the potential, at least with Esav, has the potential for that terrible destruction and evil, which is what happened. But our lesson is, our message is to know ourselves, to take our proclivities and to channel them properly. And if we have that impulsive, you know, impulsive proclivity, you know, use the Yaakov inside of us to rein ourselves in, to think, to contemplate, to meditate, to pray. And that's we should all be zocha to merit, to take our Yaakovs inside of ourselves and to rein in our Esavs.